Hej och välkomna till Prestationspodden. Jag heter Caroline Norbeli och jag driver den här podden för att sprida kunskap om stress. Men också för att jag vill ta reda på hur lever man i den här världen och mår bra och hur presterar man och mår bra. Jag har ett nyhetsbrev som jag kanske ska döpa om till månadsbrev för att hjälpa mig själv lite. Där skriver jag i alla fall de bästa tipsen från våra gäster och deras klokskaper. Och ja, det får du inte missa. Det kan också vara tips om mina retreats eller kurser jag skapat eller gästernas böcker som lottas ut. Så vill du ta del av det en gång i månaden, sisådär, så kan du gå in på carolinenorbeli.com. Jag sitter på yogamanna och jag har haft några kunder och jag känner mig fortfarande helt centrerad. Alltså, det har ni aldrig hört förut. Jag mår så bra och det är på grund av mitt egna retreat som jag har drivit. Jag har varit i Deja, vilket är platsen där jag verkligen hör hemma. Jag har inte varit överallt i världen, men det känns som att jag njuter på cellnivå när jag är där. Men i det här fallet så drev jag det här retreatet där vi vandrar 5 timmar upp i bergen. Vi yogar varje dag, vi äter hälsosamt. Men även om man gör allt det där och jag driver det här retreatet så skulle det kunna vara jobbigt. För det är ändå 10 personer som ska bo ihop och vi, ja, det ska ju göra saker och det ska planeras. Men den här gruppen var så härlig. Den gav så mycket energi. Varje person i den här gruppen var otroligt energigivande. Och jag vet att det är många av dem som lyssnar på podden. Så jag har ju sagt det på retreatet också. Och jag menar det verkligen. Jag är helt påfylld och jag tackar för det. Att jag hade sån tur att det var just du som lyssnar som var på retreatet som kom dit. Och nu tar jag hand om min vardag på ett helt nytt sätt. Det var kanske i kombination av att jag satte tema för det här retreatet. För er som följer mig på Instagram, Caroline och Billy Coaching, har kanske sett då att temat för det här fantastiska retreatet var att ta plats. Jag träffar så mycket människor, kvinnor, som inte har förmåga att ta plats. Och det är ingenting vi ska skämmas för, utan vi har inte fått lära oss att ta plats. Vi har inte fått lära oss att ta plats i vår familj. Vi kanske inte har fått lära oss att ta plats gentemot vår man. Vi har inte kanske fått lära oss att ta plats på jobbet. Våga ta plats för när det är någon som är auktoritär. Vi kanske inte har fått lära oss att ta plats nog att andas när det är jobbigt. Så på det här retreatet så fick man liksom ta plats med sin personlighet. Inte hela tiden tänka på andra, utan se till vad man själv behöver. Och behövde man lämna gruppen så fick man göra det. Och inte, jag sa det, återupprepade att lämna gruppen om man behöver. Man behövde inte vara med på allting, utan känna att man bara får ro i att andas, att göra det bekvämt för sig själv, att ta maten, eller liksom ta mat, var den första som tar middagsmaten, att inte hela tiden liksom offra sig själv för andra, utan tvärtom. Och de, antagligen var det så att de började göra det på ett väldigt fint och naturligt sätt, och att det speglade sig även till mig att jag också gjorde det. Och därför, typ fjärde dagen, så undrade jag lite så här, är det här ens ett jobb? Jag brukar faktiskt vara rätt trött. Det brukar vara saker man måste parera. Det brukar vara mycket. Alltså jag älskar att göra de här retreaten alltid. Men jag menar, ni som jobbar med människor, ni vet ju. Men det var så påfyllande. Det var så otroligt. Och vi hade det så bra. Alltså, vandringen upp på berget som kan vara ganska tuff ibland. var bara helt enkelt. Vi fick det perfekta vädret. Yogan var helt underbar. Min kropp har verkligen svarat an på den där yogan. Så faktiskt så... Ja, det var en påminnelse till mig själv. För även om jag förespråkar yoga och meditation har jag på samma sätt som er svårigheter att få in det i vardagen. Men det är någonting jag måste göra. Så att efter det här försnacket så ska jag yoga innan nästa kund kommer. Det är så viktigt för mig att få den här styrkan i magen. Och jag tror det är det för dig som lyssnar också. Att få styrka i kår. Så. Men ja, så jag tänker det. Vad viktigt det är att ha med sig att våga ta plats. Eller att öva på att våga ta plats. Ta plats i livet. Att det är något som vi inte har fått med oss. Så att det är någonting vi måste jobba på. Och jag har 8 platser kvar i på mitt retreat i oktober. 5-8 oktober. Är du intresserad av det kan du gå in på carolinnorbeli.com. Följ med. Det är helt underbart. Någonting jag tänkte på när jag vandrade runt där i bergen och var där i Soler till exempel, den lilla byn, eller i Deja och sådär, är att det här ekorrhjulet som vi håller på med, ja, man kanske kan tycka att jag har ett lite udda liv med prestationspodden och med att jag driver eget så, men det är ändå något slags ekorrhjul med barnen och så. Men att det är ju bara någon som bluff vi har kommit på att vi måste göra. Man kan faktiskt bara slå sig fri och göra någonting helt annat. Ja, det ni kanske, du som lyssnar kanske tycker att ja, det här var inga nyheter. Men för mig var det så tydligt att det fanns massa människor där som lever på ett annat sätt än vad vi gör. De har ett långsammare tempo, de är gladare, de bryr sig inte så mycket hela tiden om allting. De bryr sig inte om vad grannen tycker. Eller de bara... Ja, men det kanske de gör, men det är inte samma... De är inga strebers. Alltså, de är den här damen som jag beskrev i något avsnitt tidigare. Som bara dansar sig fram. Som bara inte bryr sig om någon annan, som njuter av stunden. Alltså det blir ju så tydligt. Det är ju därför alla älskar att byta miljö och komma till ett annat land där man får vara fri. Och det kände jag verkligen. Och apropå den där damen, för det pratade jag ju i ett eget avsnitt, så kommer ett eget avsnitt nästa vecka. Ja, oklart om vad jag ska prata om än, men... Det kommer, och jag har ju sagt att det ska komma så där en gång i månaden, men tiden rusar ju. Så jag har inte fått plats med det, helt enkelt. Och en annan sak som vi gjorde under retreatet som jag kan prata mig varmt om med mina kunder, det är att skriva morgondagbok. Alltså skriva av dig in liksom när du vaknar, om du har mycket tankar och oro. Vissa vaknar ju med mycket tankar och oro. Att ha en ritual där du bara skriver. Skriver så mycket du orkar. I all respekt för er som har småbarn och så. Hinner man inte med det då, så tycker jag att man även kan ta den stunden på kvällen. Skriva av sig gör att man lättar det som oroar en, det som gör allting oklart, till att skriva ner, till att man får en mer klarhet inombords. Så man lämpar över sig den här ångesten eller stressen i den här lilla boken. Och en bok som jag väldigt... som är så fin också, för jag tycker det är viktigt att man känner att man... den här, om man ska skapa en sån typ av ritual, att man känner att den här ritualen, att man gör det med en fin bok som kanske lyfter den lite, så är det en kvinna som jag gärna skulle intervjua, men hon hon gillar inte att vara så publik, men hon heter Sanna Sporrong, och du kan gå in på www.sporrongform.se, och hon skriver böcker och de är så fina och snygga, och där har hon en bok som heter Morgondagboken som är bara helt underbar att använda. Och man kan ju ha en bok som man, vilken bok man vill, men jag tror att när man ska sätta nya rutiner så är det ju bra att investera lite i den. Investera lite i den nya rutinen. Ja, jag har platser i höst i min coaching. Det vet ni ju redan. Så om ni är intresserade av det så borde ni gå in på carolinorbilly.com och signa upp. För jag tror att det kommer, den kommer fyllas upp ganska snabbt. Men jag har ju skapat någonting nytt och ja, någonting spännande i alla fall tycker jag. Och det är en kurs som handlar om att minska stress och minska prestationskrav. Handlar om att hjälpa dig att hantera dina prestationskrav och din stress. Och den kursen är 6 gånger och man ses på onsdagskvällar mellan 7 och 8:30. Och mellan varje gång så får man uppgifter att jobba på. Vi kommer ha en Facebookgrupp där man kan dela det man jobbar med om man vill. Man kan också bara jobba helt ensamt och inte vara så delaktig med de andra. Men jag tror på just den här gruppgrejen är det bra att liksom vilja dela med sig för att läka. Och ni som anmäler er kommer även ha tillgång till en coaching session tillsammans med mig. Och upplägget är att vi jobbar med stresshantering och prestationskrav och gränssättning och tankar och tankemönster och compassion och att möta sin inre kritiker. Och dessutom avslutar då med att skapa en hållbar vision. Och är du intresserad av det så gå in på min mediokra hemsida och signa upp på carolinnorbeli.com och gå in på kurser. I det här avsnittet så har jag intervjuat en fantastisk person. Jag har intervjuat på engelska och på något sätt när jag pratar engelska i podden så är det som att jag... Ja, jag hittar inte riktigt orden som jag gör på det jag vill säga är att jag är mycket bättre i verkligheten på att prata engelska än i podden. Ja, men alltså det är svårt, man har så mycket tankar när någon berättar om sitt liv och så att man vill ju svara an på det på alla sätt och vis. Det är som att hela min kropp vill prata, men hur som helst. Jag har intervjuat en person som har verkligen gett ett avtryck hos mig. Hon heter Michelle Baker och varför jag tog kontakt med henne är för att hon är breathwork-instruktör. Och jag är intresserad av det och jag ställde frågan på mitt Instagram och då fick jag svaret från väldigt många att intervjua Michelle Baker. Jag ska själv lyssna på det här avsnittet igen. Jag blev väldigt tagen av hennes berättelse. Så lyssna till Michelle Baker.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends.
For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Prestationspodden, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. I have been looking forward to do this. I heard you for a long time ago, or quite a long time ago, at Healthfulnesspodden.
Oh, yes. Such a nice conversation.
Mm. And also when I asked my listeners, who do they want to hear to speak about breath work, it was your name coming up a lot.
That's sweet.
And pretty cool, since as everybody can hear, you're not from Stockholm.
No, I am not from Sweden.
Or you're not from Sweden.
Yeah. Mm.
So tell me where you're from and who are you?
Who am I? I think I'm still trying to discover that too.
Me too.
But I was born in upstate New York, so about 3 hours north of New York City, in the countryside. So quite different from where I live now. I live in Varberg. So I live on the west coast of Sweden, right on the ocean. So definitely a different landscape, similar climate, but different landscape.
Mm. So how has it been for you to move here?
It's been bittersweet. I'm very happy to be here. The first couple of years were a little bit difficult. It was surprisingly a little bit of a culture shock to come. I came directly from New York City, so I lived there for about 10 years. Mm. And I was ready to leave New York, so I was thinking of actually heading to Colorado, which is a completely different landscape than Sweden for the most part. But I met my partner in Mexico, of all places, and we decided it would be easiest for me to be in Sweden than for him to try to come to the States.
Mm. Oh, so how has it been? I mean, as we talked earlier about the energy in New York, is like, I love New York, but to live there, I think it's too much for me because you sort of have the same thing going on inside of you. It's a reflection, but it must be so much more quiet for you.
Yeah, it is definitely a lot quieter. Mm-hmm. Definitely not as busy. I spent my 20s in New York. And looking back, I can't imagine spending them anywhere else. I'm super, super grateful for those experiences. And I used to say that I feel like once I got into my 30s, I was like, oh, okay, I survived my 20s. Okay, here we go. Because every year of my 20s was so vastly different. It was like every year was a 10-year growth spurt. I don't know if it was because I lived in the city and it brought so much with it. But it's definitely, yeah, I think 10 years was enough to be there.
And what is the greatest differences from?
The energy, for sure. I mean, of course, I don't think there's any city quite like New York. But I'm often asked, like, what I miss about the States or what I miss about New York, or do I miss New York and do I miss the States? And I think what I reflect on the most is I miss the sense of familiarity of, you know, when I'm driving, I know what every sign says. I'm pretty familiar with the culture and I know what to expect from people, you know, for the most part. But I really, really miss taking myself to dinner at night and just getting to know the person that sits next to you at the bar, or taking myself to a coffee shop and striking up a conversation with someone, and all of a sudden you're friends. And one of my closest friends for a long time, we lived in the same neighborhood in Brooklyn, and we were both just starting off as holistic health coaches. And so at the time, I don't know when this was, it must have been 2013 or so, and we had our business cards. So every coffee shop had a million business cards. And she saw my business card and she emailed me. She's like, we're in the same neighborhood. We do the same thing. Let's meet for a coffee. And it was like our first date. as friends, and we became such good friends after that. And I miss those ways of communicating and connecting.
Oh, cool. Because we have gone to the same school, IIN.
Yes.
And
yes.
It was a very special school for me. And you changed a lot. So when I went to that school, I needed new friends, sort of. Friends with the same interest. So I understand that that was very good for you.
Yeah, it's helpful to have conversations with someone who's kind of on the same wavelength or has similar interests.
And you were in the fashion business, no?
Oh, yes. My first college experience was in San Diego, in California. And I went to school for fashion design and technology. And I spent, I think it was about 3 years, maybe 3.5 years in California. And after school, I went on to be an assistant children's wear designer. So I designed children's clothes for a little while. It was called Little Bogies. And the clothes looked very much like they were little golfers. It was really cute. And then at some point, my boss decided to sell her company and shift gears. And that was kind of my opening to head back to New York and head to New York City for the first time. I was really homesick for the East Coast. The West Coast and the East Coast are so different in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I really miss the change of seasons and, you know, the crassness of the East Coast.
Mm. And how was the fashion business for you?
It was difficult. In San Diego, it was a lot different than in New York. In New York, it took me about maybe 3 or 4 months to land just an internship. And so that was an unpaid internship. And I worked within a very small business. And I did the business backing. So I worked with the people who were doing the sewing and the pattern making and all that and the fabric sourcing and things like that. And I really, really wanted to write. I wanted to work with the magazines. I wanted to work with styling. And it took a long time to get there. And once I did, I really crashed. And I don't know what the industry is like now. This was around 2007, 2008. Mm. So it's a tough industry to get into.
What way did you crash?
I had my first anxiety attack. I was an assistant stylist for a pretty well-known company. And they gave me a set of earrings to keep track of. And it was the only creation of these earrings. No other ones existed. And they were quite expensive. And I thought I left my bag somewhere. So I thought I left my bag on the subway. I couldn't find it anywhere. And so I was panicking. It was the only job I had was to keep track of these earrings. And that panic led to an anxiety attack. And I remember calling the lady who was a lead stylist and, you know, she was upset and I ended up finding the earrings, so it was no big deal afterwards. But I couldn't believe I was having an anxiety attack over losing something material, like a pair of earrings. It wasn't that big of a deal, you know. So that really sent a wake-up call in my system of what am I doing? What's going on here?
It was, I never got that awakening because I was in advertising. I remember I was working as an art director. And it was such a pressure not to do wrong.
Yes.
So you had so much stress. Mm-hmm. I remember because of that stress, I lost the key to the company I was working for. Oh. And the owner of the company, my boss, he punished me. In the way that he didn't give me a key. Oh. So I had to always wait for him outside. And I was always first and always last one to go. So it was like, hello, come on, give me a key. I was also so afraid of doing wrong. And I can't understand how you can have a business like that. I mean, I can see my son, he's playing football. Mm. When he's in teams where it's okay to lose and okay to do something wrong, he plays fantastic.
Yeah.
But when he's in a team, when it's like, you have to do right, you have to be good, we can't lose this, then he freezes.
Yeah.
And he freezes in the same way as my customers freezes when they go to their jobs or mm-hmm. whatever. Oh.
Well, if there's no room for failure, there's like much less room for success. You can't have one without the other. It's impossible.
Mm.
You know. Mm.
So what happened with you there? You got your first panic attack, and
yeah. And for a while, when I was in the fashion industry, I a lot of my ways to deal with my anxiety or my stress or even with depression was to be in the kitchen. So I come from a background of eating disorders. So my relationship with food hasn't always been incredibly healthy until I started going to the gym and just realizing that my body needed more. And so I would be in the kitchen. I'd be making all my food. So my control went from not eating to controlling everything I ate. So, you know, for better or worse, it was at least I was eating food and consuming. But that also helped me with my anxiety within the fashion industry or within my work in general. And at some point, the partner that I had at the time suggested that I go to culinary school. His sister, I think, had just gone to culinary school, or she was in it. And that might be where the idea came from. And yeah, I enrolled. I'm kind of a yes person. If someone suggests something, I listen for that gut response. And if something really resonates, I just go for it. And yeah, so I decided to drop out of the fashion industry, and I enrolled into culinary school.
Another tough.
Another very tough industry, yes. Especially to be a woman within that industry in New York City. It was tough. Mm.
I have met a few people working in that industry. Of course, I know many, but sometimes it's a lot of pressure, it seems like.
Yeah, a lot of pressure, again, to do right, to serve the customers, to not, we had this term, when you 86 something, that means there's no more of it. It's off the menu for the night. And if you don't get that right on track, if you don't like totally keep on track of how much food you've got or what's going on, or you fire something, or like you put something into the pan at the exact moment it's needed, so it goes out when it's hot. It was a Michelin star restaurant, so everything was very, very, very particular.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, that must be very scary.
Yeah, but also beautiful. I learned so much about food, and I learned so much about the back end of the industry and being a cook in a restaurant and the energy that goes into your food and how that affects the whole restaurant experience. And, I've never been... I dine out differently now. I have so much respect for everything that's going on before the food even gets in front of me.
Oh, that
so that's really
fantastic.
Changed my experience.
And how did your panic attack continue, or what happened?
I don't know if I had more. I think it was more of an anxiety attack than a panic attack. And I'm not sure I had more. I've had really intense moments of anxiety, and I still do. I get really anxious before I talk, like things like this. So I try to tap into some techniques that help just soothe my system a little bit more. I ended up leaving the restaurant industry because it was too much. I actually asked for a raise because what I was making was very, the waiters and the bartenders and everyone made so much more than the chefs did or the cooks did. And so I asked for a raise, and my chef was amazing. She was a prominent female chef in the industry. And she came back to me and she's like, I'm so sorry. It's not anything I can control, but we can give you a 25-cent raise. And it was just like a stab in the heart. And I was like, like, amazing. Oh, like I'm working oh. so hard. You work like 80-hour work weeks and the kitchen becomes your family, you know? Mm. So I decided to leave and I went on to be a private chef for a couple of different families. And even that was enjoyable, nice. But stressful. Mm. It was a lot more creative. I didn't have to just make what, you know, the restaurant wanted us to make. I could get more creative in the menus. And that was a lot of fun. But that's when I went on to study at IIN and to learn a little bit more about nutrition and include that within the private chef sessions and so on.
What year was that?
That was 2012. So 10 years ago, which is crazy. But when did you go to IIN?
I did that 5 years ago.
5 years ago. Okay, cool. I think when I started, it was just as they were going online. I think before then, they still had classes in person. And then once a year or twice a year, they would do these big gatherings. One of the convention centers where you'd come to see
it.
Yeah, it was fun. You'd come to see all these different speakers and so on and meet other people who graduated.
Because it's really like for the listeners, it's like Bernstein, Gabriela Bernstein, she's a teacher, Deepak Chopra, and many more.
It's fantastic. And I don't even know if she was. I don't know if Gabby Bernstein was even teaching at that point for them.
But I went to New York. I'm quite, I didn't know. I went to New York when I was studying at IIN, but I didn't really understand if it was a digital school or if there was a school in New York. So I went to visit and it was like, hello, no, this is not just an office.
I think a long time ago it was. I don't even know if they still do those like convention things where they bring everyone together, but I think it went fully online now. The world went online the past couple of years.
So you started a new career when you went to IIN, or what happened?
Yeah, it was a really slow shift. So right before I started going to IIN, during that time, I was in a really difficult relationship for about 8 years, kind of on and off, a little bit toxic, a little bit addictive, a little of everything, you know, late teens, young 20s, tough relationship. So when I was going to IIN, I was working with a coach. I don't know if they still do it. They set you up with a coach. At the time, it was a one-on-one. You had a coach one-on-one.
Yes, we coached it. We met up and had sessions.
Yeah. Okay. And that was my first experience ever working with someone in like a therapeutic setting or a coaching setting ever. And it was so empowering. I love my coach. Her name is Jessica, and she's still coaching to this day, I'm pretty sure. And we were working on strengthening me because I had these moments. I had a real, like literal down on my knees moment of why can't I leave this relationship? I knew it was so toxic. I knew it wasn't good for me. I had friends that I lost during it because they knew as well. But I just couldn't leave. It felt so addictive. And I remember talking with her and something she asked me about, like, what makes you feel strong? And I told her that, you know, I had severe asthma growing up and I was always told that I couldn't run because I'd have an asthma attack or something along those lines. And she said, you know, I hadn't had an asthma attack in a really long time. And she encouraged me to start running or, you know, finding a buddy to run with. And I did. A good friend of mine, Sarah Quinn, and I started running along the highway in New York, the Hudson Highway. And I really felt so strong. Like my lungs felt strong. My body felt strong. You know, I could only run a little bit at a time before I really wanted to puke. But I really could feel my body get so much stronger. And I think that really rippled into me being able to leave this relationship.
And that
was really incredible. And that is where everything really started. So it was, summer 2012. I left that. I started going to Bhakti Yoga, which was a beautiful experience. I found a teacher that I still love to this day. Her name's Pepper Monroe. And going to her classes really helped me as well. And that was kind of my holistic health experience in the yoga world and movement and breath and all those things.
So you started to get curious.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm often asked what brought me into these different things, like what made me want to study nutrition or coaching, or what made me want to go into a yoga class. And I don't really know what brings me into things. I think it's suggestion, or someone mentions it, or conversation, or I see it somewhere. But I know with yoga in particular, it was heartache, it was heartbreak. And I really needed to find something to help me.
Mm. Yeah. So he sort of helped you.
Yeah, for sure. I see it like that now. It took me a while to see it like that then. And I remember about a year later, we met up, and he was going through his own healing process. And you know, I remember so specifically, I was working at a cafe at the time in Tribeca, one of my favorite jobs to this day. And I was sitting, we were sitting on a curb on the side of the road. And he said to me, like, have you forgiven me? Have you had a chance to forgive me? And it was so interesting because I remember thinking, like, of course, like, I think I forgave you the day I left, but I still haven't forgiven myself for being in that situation for so long and staying in it when I knew it wasn't good for me. And that, like, that healing process took a very long time. So seeing him in a different light, you know, took a little time, but it was probably the easier process of it all than it was to see myself in a different light or to build that internal forgiveness.
Oh,
but he definitely helped me push me into this direction that I'm in now, for sure.
Yeah. Sometimes, you don't understand when you're in a bad situation, and it pushes you to something very good. But it's a good advice, I think, for people who are in that same relationship to start to do something which is very good for you, like you did with the running, to start empowering you because you are so broken. And you need to do something new, I think, or to look at the situation in from another angle.
Yeah, a different perspective. And sometimes all it takes is for someone to ask you, like, what makes you feel strong, or, you know, or even the opposite, like, where do you feel weak? And I felt weak in relationship. I've not only relationship with this person, but relationship with myself. I didn't know who I was or what I could do, or what I was capable of. And I think that's kind of what landed me in that position.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to talk about, too, a conversation I've had with a friend recently of, you know, sharing that story with her and telling her, I know what it feels like to be in something and, you know, have these conversations of, why can't I just leave? And I think a lot of people have that situation or have been in that situation. And, like, I felt so stupid. I felt so, I don't know, I just couldn't understand, with all the information I knew, why I couldn't just, like, gather the strength to go. So I think it's important to have that conversation too, so you don't feel so alone.
If you don't mind me asking, where did your, or does your anxious, what do you say it, anxious?
Yeah, when I'm anxious.
Anxious, yeah. A very difficult word, but anyway, why do you have those feelings?
The anxious feelings. I'm sure they come from a variety of different things. I think my anxiety that comes up before I speak, or when eyes are directed on me, or when I'm meant to deliver. Is I'm so afraid of not meeting someone's expectation.
Oh, me too.
And a teacher of mine said this so beautifully the other day. Her name's Allie, and I reference her quite often. She said, you know, when you're in this room of 10 people, we're in a group mentorship, and there's, you know, 10 of us there and plus herself. And she says, all of you have a different expectation of me. All of you have a different view of me. You know, I might remind you of someone, my voice might remind you of someone. You might have heard me say this one thing before, and that might have given you something that you, you know, you think about me or you expect from me. And then she says, you know, I have my own expectation of myself and I can't meet the expectation of the 11 of us. It's so impossible to do. And that really kind of relaxed something in me that I'm never going to meet the expectation that someone has of me. I mean, I can barely meet the expectation I have of myself.
I think that's what it is. It's your own expectations, which is very difficult to meet.
Yeah. Mm. And I think in the wellness world, at least in my, you know, perception of it, a lot of us can be seen as like experts in the field.
Oh.
And by no means am I an expert of anything I do. I just, you know, I try my best to stay well studied and well informed and feed that curious brain. Since I was a kid, I've always wanted to be seen as someone who was smart or wise or intelligent. I remember my dad always, I loved to read. And I read pretty fast, so I don't know how much I actually absorbed. But he would always be like, oh, you're such a smart kid. You read so fast. And, you know, always called me smart or intelligent. And I never felt like that inside. So I always felt like I had to live up to that. And, you know, he always meant it in a really sweet and loving way. But since a part of me internally never felt like that, it always felt like an expectation I had to live up to. And I wanted to make him proud. You know, so I think that's where anxiety comes up too, of like, what if I say the wrong thing? What if I, don't say something correctly or get the science wrong or, yeah.
Oh, I understand. The pressure from parents. We haven't talked about your asthma. When did that started?
I had pretty severe asthma when I was a child. I was actually talking with my mom about it the other day. I don't remember a lot from my childhood, and I know I'm not alone in that. A lot of us don't. Nope. But I was asking her the other day, actually after our conversation, when my asthma came up, and it was when I was around 7. So it was a few months before my grandmother passed away. And my grandmother was a nurse. So a lot of my mom's side are nurses and pharmacists and so on. And I was having a lot of breathing issues. And my mom can remember so specifically one night that she said it was always worse at night. And so she'd always prop me up with pillows in bed. She said that I would have these really dark circles under my eyes. And that's how she always knew I was having trouble breathing. And then she'd prop me up in bed. And I don't know how she worded it, but she said that one of those nights, I worded it along the lines of like, I felt like I was dying. Like I really just couldn't breathe well. And I was 7, 6 or 7. And my grandmother thought I had asthma at the time. And so they, you know, they brought me to the doctor and I was eventually diagnosed with asthma. And a lot of it was affected by the weather. If it was too humid or too cold or too hot. And it was affected by different animals, different cats and dogs and things like that. And so most nights or a lot of nights I would be hooked up to what we call a nebulizer. I don't know if it's the same in Sweden, but there was a little steroid you'd put into this tube and it would move steam through it. So it was like you're holding onto this hose in your mouth and it was moving the steroid through your body via steam. And I remember like the first few moments it was like, oh, I could really feel my lungs open up and I could really feel myself take a deep breath. And it was like new life.
For how long did that continue? I mean, how many years did you have asthma or
I don't know
severe
how
asthma?
Many years it was so severe for. I mean, I had a nebulizer always with me. I remember it was like this orange container, like this orange machine. I had it even up into like my early 20s. I remember having it in my closet in New York City with always a couple of these little packets of medicine in case I ever needed it. And then I always had an inhaler on me just in case. But I don't remember, it did fade out over time. I remember being in high school and whenever we had these exercises where we had to run a mile or something, it was always like me and a couple other kids who had asthma that would always walk the track instead of run. So you always felt a little bit like an oddball. So I remember it was definitely through asthma or through high school. And my uncle had boxers, the dogs. Mm-hmm. And every time I went there, I needed my inhaler. So it was something about the dander of the boxers. And that was up into my early 20s. So it was always just kind of affected by animals. But I don't remember the last time I used a nebulizer or an inhaler. It's been a very long time.
And that time with asthma as a little, what did that teach you? Hard times often teach you something.
Oh, man. I mean, probably a lot more than I know, especially as a seven-year-old. But I don't know. I don't know if this relates, but I don't know why this is coming to mind right now, but I'll share it anyway. But I remember I was really, really close with my grandmother when I was little. She always babysat me. Mm. I was super connected. This is my mom's mom, my mother's mother. And I remember, like I said, I was diagnosed with asthma maybe a few months before she died. And I remember so vividly the moment my dad was sitting on the couch, and it was the first time I ever saw him emotional, like him moving, like crying. And so he had me, and my mom had my sister, who was a couple of years older than me. Sorry, you might hear my dog in the background. And he explained to me that my grandmother had passed away, that she would no longer be around, and I knew things were happening because they would drop us off at our brother's house. And my brother is like 12 years older than me. So he would babysit, him and his girlfriends would babysit us. And so I knew something was happening because my parents kept going to the hospital and things like that. And I remember when he was telling me, and he was so emotional, and I remember not crying. My mom tells me I never cried and never mourned her death or never cried when they told us. And she was pretty shocked by that. And I don't know if it was because I saw my dad be emotional and I felt like I had a hold for him, but I so vividly remember like asking, what does that mean? Like, where did she go? And I think it was my mom that said that she went to heaven. We're Irish Catholic, so we believed in heaven. And I didn't know what that mean. And she'll live forever in heaven. And that to me felt so scary. That you can live forever somewhere. So it wasn't really like the death that was scary. Even if I think about it too much to this day, it gets me a little freaked out. I wasn't so scared of death, but I was so scared of afterwards you live forever. Like, what is that experience? That sounds scary. Like no end to something. And so that was really, I don't know, all of that was very interesting for me. Cool. But it was years later that I actually mourned her death, and it was through a breathwork experience.
Oh, yeah, you told me earlier on. We have that in common.
Yeah.
I should be very close to our grandmothers.
Mm. It is. Both of your grandmothers or your mom's mom?
Both of my grandmothers, but my father's mother is, she is dead, but we are very close.
Yeah. Do you still feel a connection close. To her today?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Neiman, when I called for a cat, we were about to buy a cat, and her cat's name was Fräulein when she was living.
Cute.
And I just called, and they said, well, we have one cat left, but only, so you know, the cat's name is Fräulein.
Of course.
And I was like, okay. And that was like 1 year after she died. Uh-huh. And I don't know if it is that I want to see her still. Mm-hmm. She was, we were so alike, but also different. But she was working with prisoners and she helped them to find a job.
Oh, wow.
And that is like coaching.
Yeah, sort of.
Mm-hmm. So we our brains were very alike. Mm-hmm. And so it's I miss her a lot. But
I feel like that
with
my grandmother too. I feel like she was the only one that really understood me.
You know? That is the same. Yeah. We could look at each other and we knew.
Yeah.
And it was so nice to mm-hmm. have a person like that.
Mm. Definitely.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, talking about breathing, how did you get into breath work?
Well, I was introduced to different styles of breath work when I started practicing yoga in, around 2012, 2013 or so.
Or sorry, did I interrupt something here? We started to talk about, you were talking about your grandmother, mm-hmm. and then I start to talk about mine. But did I interrupt? So now when I interview you in English,
you actually asked me what asthma taught me.
I went
into the conversation with my grandmother. And I don't know how that relates to what asthma has taught me. Maybe as an adult, I can understand a little bit more of, you know, just like how important it is to be able to breathe. And how it really can affect your body in so many ways. Just not even the breathwork technique that I teach a lot, which is that active breathwork technique, but just to like to have good breath hygiene affects every aspect of your body, your mental, like your mental state, your physicality, everything. So as I understand that as an adult now, I'm sure asthma kind of played a role in that somehow, but my whole family has had lungs diseases in one way or another. So it's been a very interesting karma, for lack of a better word.
I understand. So when was your first meeting with breathwork?
So with breathwork practices, like pranayama practices, mm-hmm. it was back in 2012, and just doing some practices within a yoga class like Nadi Shodhana, alternate nostril breathing, or diaphragmatic breathing, where you're really just filling up the belly. And then it was in 2015, we had one of our teachers in our yoga teacher training was a Kundalini teacher. And so she taught us some different Kundalini Kriyas, I think they're called. Mm-hmm. And that uses a lot of different breath practices. And I felt so empowered after that, those classes. It felt so, so good to really use my lungs and like stress my body in that way.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And so I really fell in love with that. And so I continued to find different breath practices throughout. But a couple of months later, I was actually invited by a friend to do a Reiki course. And it was one of those moments where I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And before the course, I had to go have a Reiki session with someone. And through Instagram, through the beauty of social media, I found a woman named Erin Telford. And she was working just south of Midtown Manhattan at the time. And I went to her for a Reiki session, and she went on to be my acupuncturist as well. So she was really the one to introduce me to a lot of things, Reiki, acupuncture, and eventually breath work. And she had studied for a while with David Elliott, who's also my breathwork teacher, for this active technique.
Is he famous for his breathwork knowledge or?
I think he's pretty humble, so I don't imagine he would say that he's famous. No, but he's very well known for this breathwork technique.
Because I heard the name passing.
Yeah. Oh. So he's pretty well known for this particular technique. Oh. And he's written a couple of books on the breath and so on too. Mm-hmm. And I was doing Reiki sessions and acupuncture sessions with her. And this might have been in the beginning of her practice with inviting breathwork with her clients. And she recommended I go to a group breathwork class just with some things that we had talked about and some of the anxiety I was experiencing and, you know, bits of depression. And yeah, she couldn't really explain much about it, but she said, you know, come in for the group experience. At the time, the, you know, individual sessions were more expensive than I could afford. So the group experience was a little bit more affordable. Yeah, so I decided to go, and it was a very wild experience in so many ways. It was in this beautiful space that no longer is there, but it was called Maha Rose in Greenpoint in Brooklyn. Yeah, it was just a wild experience in and of itself.
Cool. Oh, and what did you experience?
The class itself, there was probably 40 of us there, and we started in a circle. She explained a little bit to us, not a whole lot. There's a lot of physical experiences and emotional experiences I didn't really expect. She might have explained it, and I just kind of was in my head and not listening. She took us through a meditation, and we all laid down almost hand in hand. It was a very small space, and we just laid out blankets, and everyone just sprawled out on the ground. And she brought us through this breath technique. And as we were breathing, you know, I felt a little bit lightheaded at first, and somebody next to me started crying. Somebody on the other side of the room started laughing. And I was like, what is going on? I was like, this is, you know, I was a little bit apprehensive. I was like, you know, I trusted her completely. And she came over and she put these rocks in my hands, these little stones in my hands. And I felt so grounded. And I just knew she was there. And I knew she'd take care of me if anything were to happen. And so I just kind of surrendered to the breath, and I surrendered to the practice. And my body, my physical body, had all these responses of my hands got a little bit tight, my toes got tight, my mouth got tight. And, you know, somebody next to me started laughing, and I just couldn't stop laughing. And I remember thinking about it, like, this is so weird, you know, just trying to analyze it. I just couldn't stop laughing, and it felt so good. And it felt like I could breathe more when I was laughing. And then I started bawling. I started just sobbing. And even that, like, it didn't feel scary. It was just
natural.
So interesting. And then eventually we went into this rest phase, and she had this wonderful music. She had Prince Purple Rain was playing and all these different songs to kind of help you move through emotion. And I remember going into the rest phase, and I was a chef at the time, and my hands were like little claws. And I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to cut a vegetable again.
Because they got stiff.
So they got really stiff. Yeah, it can happen in this type of breath work sometimes.
Cool.
And laying there in that rest phase, it was like total bliss. Mm. It felt like I was both so heavily grounded and floating at the same time. And I remember feeling this feeling of nothing matters. Like, it's no big deal. Everything's okay. No sense of anxiety or depression or worry. And it was, I felt like the first time in my life I ever felt like that. Of like, everything's okay. And it makes me emotional just thinking about it now, that feeling that you get. And I knew right away that the experience I had, that was going to shift the whole dynamic of the work that I did. Mm. I wasn't totally sure how, but I knew I was going to go on to teach this practice. And it took me several years to do, maybe 3 years before I went on to do a training. But the breath continued to make a huge impact in my life. And I remember going through a breath practice, and that's kind of where I found out that I never mourned my grandmother passing. Mm. I was actually really angry at her for passing. And a lot of that came in the breathwork practice, followed by a really big cry. But the breath has given me a lot of tools.
Beautiful. Ja. And now you are a breathwork teacher.
Yeah.
Mm. And how long did it take before you start to study or became a breathwork teacher?
I went to study with David in, I think, spring 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Almost exactly 4 years ago. He came to Italy and he was doing a week-long training. And mm-hmm. so I went there with my closest friend, Alex, and studied with him. And for me, if I wait to teach something, I might never teach it.
Exactly.
So it was like my teacher, Pepper, who was my yoga teacher, who I mentioned, she also did the breathwork training. So I set up private sessions with her virtually to come back to after the training, just to kind of keep me in it. And so I would do sessions with her. And then I think a month later, I had my first group breathwork session, and where I was bringing other people in, and I had a couple of private sessions with friends to see what it felt like to bring them through the sessions. So I started teaching almost directly afterwards.
I tried one of your sessions or through the computer, but yeah. For me it was like you created a piece of art. It was mm-hmm. not just a session where I was breathing. It was also a piece of art. That I want to do it again, though, because those weeks now have been so much for me mentally because of this retreat, because yes. It's like top on having customers, having Prestationspodden and going to Mallorca and two kids and and a husband who so went away for this week for a week. But so I will do it again. And it was like magic for me.
Mm.
It was fantastic. Everyone should try it.
Did you feel any shifts in your body? Like, did you feel a difference before and after at all?
I had another. I interviewed a person called Anders Olsson. He was talking about breathing through the nose.
Yes, very important.
And then I had I talked to you about breathing, and then I did your breathwork session. And for me, it has shifted a lot. I have started to breathe through my nose now, and I have been watching myself during the days how I breathe, when I know that I have to sort of achieve, and I really try to think about my breathing, because even when I meet a customer, it could happen that I close my breathing.
Yeah, like hold your breath a little bit.
Hold my breath.
Yeah.
Because, and I teach others to think about
it. I do the same. We're all together.
So it has been like a start for me, and I'm so interested to continue this, and I will come to your breathwork classes, and I will explore this, because mm-hmm. I feel I am quite sure, and I have said that for so many years, that we wouldn't have so many diagnoses, I think, if we taught children to breathe.
Yeah.
I mean, because we forget how to breathe when we're in bad situations, when we're in tense families, mm-hmm. where there are we stop our breathing, and that is so it is dangerous or dangerous, but it's not good for us in the long run.
No, it's not.
And I can feel that I need to learn how to breathe even more.
Yeah, and how that affects, you know, your nervous system and how it affects, yeah, your mental state so quickly. Mm. I mean, even your emotional state, you can notice if you start to run like irritation or frustration or anything like that through your body, mm. you'll start to feel like the breath gets really short and shallow. And if you start to run like joy or happiness or relief, it's almost like the lungs fill. So it's the breath alone and changing the way you breathe, it's like quite literally has an effect on the emotional state, which will have an effect on the mental state, which will have an effect on the nervous system, which will have an effect on how we respond in the world. Right? So it's so cool. Integrated.
And I notice when I drive my car that I don't breathe.
Yes.
So, I'm sorry to say, everyone who's meeting me.
But we do the same with email. There has been this study now, like called email apnea, where people are doing their emails and they're holding their breath.
Mm. And I'm the same when I do Instagram.
Yes.
When I'm on social media, it's like. Because if there is a customer complaining or whatever.
Yeah. I was telling a friend the other day, they should, instead of all these, ads that come through, it should be just like ads that say, breathe.
Exactly.
That could at least be helpful. If you're going to keep social media, give us something to work with, Give us some reminders.
Mm. Yes, because we don't know what happens in the long run when you don't breathe properly during the days.
Yeah.
And also when you don't breathe during the days, you don't breathe during the nights.
Exactly.
I think you more.
Exactly.
More,
And both, one affects the other so much because I didn't listen to your conversation that you had with
Anders. Fantastic.
We can really see that with sleep apnea too, or when you're sleeping, when you're breathing in and out of your nose, that's a parasympathetic nervous system. So that's the restful side of the nervous system. If we're going to break it up like that, it's a very complex system. That's a simple way of explaining it. And if we're breathing in and out of the mouth, we're accessing the sympathetic nervous system, the more active style, the one that makes us a little bit more alert. So if we're sleeping at night with an open mouth, we're activating our sympathetic nervous system. So it makes us a little bit more alert. So if we can really learn to breathe in and out of our nose, especially when we're sleeping, it could change the whole rest of the day.
How long is a session, breathwork session?
It can be, I always say, at least 7 minutes. The first, in this particular style of breathwork, this active style, there's many different styles of breathwork. But with this more active style that I often teach, I usually say anywhere around 7 minutes at least, because that'll get you over that resistance phase or through that resistance phase. My teacher describes it as moving from like the masculine side of the brain to the feminine side of the brain. To me, it's almost like a shift of being in the head to being in the body. And that usually happens around the 6-7 minute mark or so. So I usually suggest at least that much time. And then you really don't need any more than 30 minutes. I think my group sessions and the one-on-one sessions are usually between 20, 25, 26 minutes of active breath work, followed by a rest of some kind.
Because that's one thing. I think to get that into your schedule, you are taught that you have to meditate and then you go out running and then exercising, and don't forget to build muscles.
The list is on and on. It's a full-time job.
So,
but
good.
With this practice, you could do 3 minutes. You could do 1 minute.
Yeah.
One of my teachers once said, close your eyes, open your eyes. You've just meditated. Mm. We complicate things so much. We analyze things so much. So even if you just set your timer for 30 seconds and do any kind of breath exercise, put your hands on your belly and breathe. Do this 3-part exercise if you want to. It doesn't have to be complicated.
And now you have like 200 or maybe more students, or what do you call it? No.
Students?
Exactly.
Yeah, more for Reiki. I've taught for Reiki. For breathwork, I don't know how many students I have. But with Reiki, I teach practitioners, and I have almost, I think like over the past 5 years, somewhere around 300 Reiki students.
Wow.
So it's a lot to work with there.
Tell us a little bit about Reiki. That is quite
so complicated. I think I often joke, and people have heard me say this numerous times, that everything I do within, you know, this field, with the, it's the breath work or the Reiki, it's like a describing it to someone is like describing a fruit you've never tasted. Mm-hmm. Like if you don't have the experience of it, it's so hard to grasp. But kind of in a nutshell, Reiki is a healing modality. It has its roots in Japan.
So where has breathwork roots?
Breathwork usually has its roots in India. So this particular practice, I think David's been teaching for like 25, 30 years. And it's something that his teacher taught him. And there's a long story about it. But almost every single breath practice is thousands of years old. And even Wim Hof, I think he teaches what's called Tummo breathwork, T-U-M-M-O. And that's it. You can see a lot of it in the really ancient texts. I don't know what the name of this one would be. David doesn't even have a name for it. He just calls it breathwork, or breathwork healing, you might hear it as.
And back to Reiki. For the listeners who doesn't know what Reiki is, what is it?
Yeah, complicated. but it's mostly a hands-on technique. Some people work with the energy body, or some people work with distant Reiki. But it's mostly a hands-on technique that works to help soothe the nervous system. It was kind of... So Reiki itself usually will translate to spiritually guided life force or universally guided life force. And depending on who you ask, Reiki also translates into a cold breeze. So there's a lot of different definitions of Reiki. There's a man named Dr. Usui, or some people call him Usui Sensei or Makao Usui, who created what's called Reiki Ryoho, or Reiki therapy. So I think Reiki gets a little bit confused because we only call it Reiki rather than calling it Reiki therapy. So Reiki itself is ancient. It's like life force. It's like the breath. And Dr. Usui created a way to kind of use this life force, use this energy. I usually compare it to the breath in a sense that no one created the breath, but people have created breath practices. No one created Reiki, but people have created ways to work with Reiki, and they call it therapy. And it's mostly a hands-on practice that helps the body land into a state of, kind of like harmony or homeostasis, or the parasympathetic side of the nervous system, so that the body can begin to heal itself or restore itself.
I don't know about breath work, but Reiki, it feels like the society hasn't really opened up for that. People can sometimes feel it's like, what is that, humbug?
There's a word for it in Swedish. What is it? I think it starts with an F.
Flummi,
yeah. I learned that word really fast when I moved here. I think it's opening a lot more. I started teaching Reiki, I don't know, maybe like 6 months after I moved here. And it's very, a little bit seen as hocus pocus. And that's more so in the Western world. In the Eastern world, it's of course we can work with energy.
Yes.
Why wouldn't we be able to? We are energy. Everything's energy. Of course, on a daily basis, we're working with that, whether we're working with something like the breath, whether we're working with visualization or anything. We're always working with energy.
What kind of experience do you get when you work as a Reiki practitioner? Some people see colors.
Yeah.
And what do you...
Yeah, so it's changed over the years. But when you're working with Reiki, it's kind of like going into a deep state of meditation. I usually say, for me, Reiki is a state. It's not something that you do. It's a state that you go into, kind of like how you go into the state of meditation. And so when that happens, usually you have a lot easier access to your intuition. And intuition shows up in a different ways for everyone. It speaks differently for everyone. For me, it sometimes speaks differently depending on the client, of how information might come through or how their body wants to communicate with me. mm-hmm. whether it's their energetic body, their physical body, their spiritual body. I'm in communication with that during a Reiki session. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that can show up in my body. So I can get mm-hmm. an ache somewhere, or I can get like a throbbing somewhere or a pain somewhere. And that'll show me where maybe to place my hands during a Reiki session, or it'll show me like what in their body is trying to balance or heal or harmonize itself. So it's just giving me some information about what the Reiki is helping with. But I don't see colors. I get so envious of people who see colors. You know, I think it sounds beautiful.
I don't see colors either.
Yeah.
But now people will think I'm flummy as well. But I have done the first step of Reiki Shodan. Healing. Mm-hmm. And when I had my hands on another student, and I get like information about her and her husband.
So how does that come for you? Is it like a knowing? Is it?
It's a knowing.
Yeah.
It's like the same knowing as I get when I coach
yes.
people.
Yeah.
I get like informations, mm-hmm. but I don't know really how. But it was very clear for me when I did it at this education. Now I start to get tired in my head.
It's like the training,
we have done this
sure.
over. And I had my hands. I didn't know her at all. I met her like an hour or something. Mm-hmm. And I was like, she has problem with her husband. And she doesn't get enough room in her relationship. Mm-hmm. And then I told my teacher asked me to tell what I felt when I had my hand. So I told her it open, like, to her. And later on, she came to me like, wow, you were spot on.
Yeah.
So it's, and the strange thing with me is that I coach, but I haven't continued with my Reiki, perhaps because it is flummit. I'm in the both... it's like I have my feet in two different worlds.
Yeah.
Like I don't know really where I'm standing. So perhaps it would be good if I go in and get flummy 100%.
Yeah, just go for it.
Because now it's realize, so confusing.
I used to tell like my students if a lot of students are a little bit nervous that someone's going to think they're like that. Mm. And it's like, well, what do you think about it? Like, what's your experience with flummy? Like, what do you think of yourself? What do you think of Reiki? And it's always that, you know, bringing it back to self-reflection.
Exactly.
But it's just, at some point, it just doesn't really matter. It goes back to that expectation of, like, I'm never going to meet anyone's expectation of me.
And exactly.
So I just got to work on what it is that I feel. But I also have a foot in both worlds. I love the science. I love the energetics of it.
I noticed that.
But it's complicated.
It is.
I've never wanted to be seen as a spiritual teacher.
Nah.
Nobody wants to call me that, and I almost threw up. I was like, oh, no.
No. But I, as I told you in our first conversation, I like to go for your Reiki course number 2 in this autumn.
More than welcome.
To step into the flummy. The flummy word.
Yeah. And I hear a lot that once, like going into Reiki level 2, I've heard this from students, kind of helps the Reiki practice land.
Oh.
Because there's so much information to learn about Reiki. Mm-hmm. So it just, you know, another step can kind of just land things a little bit deeper.
Yeah. I think I would need that as personally.
And then to meet other people who do it. I think, again, coming back to that sense of community, talking with others who do it, because then you feel less alone, or I feel less alone.
Mm.
It's such a beautiful community.
Exactly. It's the same thing as if I or whoever goes into a room with a lot of people, you can feel, there is someone who is angry. I mean,
totally.
So it's not so strange that I can feel
it's not strange at all. It's body's communicating. We do it all the time. We communicate all the time without words, all the time. Mm. And you can even feel this when you're thinking of someone and they call you. right? Or, I mean, we have this incredible technology that you and I are on, mm-hmm. where you're in Stockholm, I'm in Varberg, and somehow we're meeting, mm-hmm. right? Through the satellites or however it's happening, you know, exactly. But energy is, you know, works in a very similar way. Yeah. It's just, it's hard harder for the brain, I think more so for the Western brain, to comprehend that it can happen.
Exactly. Oh, this is very strange that we can see each other recording a podcast.
Yeah, if you think about that, that's strange too.
Oh, I have a lot more to ask you about. I mean, I love this conversation with you, and I will probably contact you again, and you can tell us more about what you're doing, breathwork, and all your thoughts. It has been very interesting for me.
Mm. Oh, very nice to speak with you too. Thank you.
And if they want to get in contact with you, where should they? Is it your web?
Yeah, the website has everything up to date more than anywhere else. So it's just michellebaker.co.co. And then Instagram, you know, is always a landing spot.
Yeah.
But yeah, website is always the most updated.
Oh, that's just good. Are you doing that yourself?
Yes. Well, I have somebody who actually, when I start, I'm going to start with her in June, and I'm going to have a whole new website with some other things happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I update everything myself.
Thank you. Have a nice day, and see you in this autumn.
Yeah, hopefully in September. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for a lovely conversation.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tack till alla er som lyssnar. Alltså, jag är så tacksam för varenda person. Och vill du hjälpa mig att sprida podden, så får du gärna skriva på Instagram när du tycker att det var bra. Jag förstår om ni inte vill göra något inlägg eller sådär, men jag blir glad för bara lite. Annars kan ni gå in på podcastrappen, lämna en recension, lämna 5 stjärnor. Så då kommer andra att hitta. Eller så skriver ni bara. Skriv vad ni tycker om podden. Hur har den hjälpt er? Då blir jag superglad. Så nästa vecka så blir det eget avsnitt för dig som tycker det är kul. Och för dig som inte, kan vänta till veckan efter. Ha det bra. Hej hej.